This is Thursday, November 19th, 2015. We are in Natick, Massachusetts, and this tape is part of the Morse Institute Library's continuing Veterans Oral History Project. My name is Maureen Sullivan. Our cameraman is Dan McDermott of Natick Pegasus. And we are privileged to have with us today Molly McLaughlin. Welcome, Molly.
Thank you.
May I ask when you were born?
July 4th, 1967.
And where were you born?
Corvallis, Oregon.
And what community do you currently live?
Marion, Massachusetts.
Your marital status?
I am divorced.
And do you have children?
Yes, I do. I have two.
I understand that you lived in Corvallis for a short time.
Correct.
Before your family moved to Cheyenne, Wyoming, and that your father served in the Air Force.
That's correct.
And can you tell us a little more about your father's career in the Air Force?
Sure. So he joined in the early 60s, and he was a missile leader, mostly with the nuclear warheads. So he served 14 years on active duty, all around nuclear programs. And after the downsizing post-Vietnam War, he was rifted out of the Air Force and joined the reserves as an enlisted soldier.
What was it like growing up in a military family during the Vietnam War?
I don't think we noticed that it was any different than anything else. So, I mean, it was our norm. You know, Dad was gone a lot because when he would go on duty, he would be gone for 3-4 days in the missile silos. So that was interesting because he was a widower. my mother, Margaret Mary, passed away in 1970. Yeah. So so when he was gone, we had a nanny that watched us and cared for us. And surprisingly, the Air Force was quite supportive of it. Even you wouldn't think so in the 70s, but they were actually. So it was, like I said, I think it was our norm, so we really didn't know. I thought everybody moved around every 3 to 4 years.
Where else did you live besides Cheyenne?
We lived in McGuire Air Force Base in New Jersey, and then we lived in upstate New York outside of Fort Drum in a town called Lowville. And then we lived in New Orleans for 3 years, and then I went to high school in Fredonia, New York.
You did bounce around.
Sure did.
And do you have any brothers or sisters?
Yeah, I have one brother and three sisters. Two are biological, two are adoptive.
You're in high school in Fredonia, New York. Did you have any leanings toward entering the military?
Oh, I knew way before that I wanted to serve. Mm-hmm. My dad, I think, wanted all of us to serve, and I was the only one that agreed with him.
Okay. So did you go in after high school?
I went to Norwich University.
Norwich, okay.
And my freshman year, I had a 3-year Air Force scholarship, and there was a boy involved, and he convinced me that I wasn't suited for the Air Force. And so I gave my scholarship up, and I joined the Vermont National Guard on April 4th, 1986, and served the remainder of my college years in the Vermont National Guard until I was commissioned from Norwich into the Army, into the Signal Corps. When I was enlisted, I was an air traffic controller.
Tell us a little more about that.
So I was in an aviation unit at the Burlington Airport, and there was a platoon of air traffic controllers. I was the tower chief for the tactical tower, so I was able to go to air assault school and do a lot of pathfinder operations, setting up airfields during operations in the middle of nowhere in Vermont, really, on top of mountains and in very, very remote places. So we would sling load the tower and rappel out and set up a airfield and out of nothing. So it was quite cool. It's probably one of the funnest jobs I've ever had in the Army.
Safe to say that this was for military aircraft?
Yes, it was helicopters.
And bouncing around for Vermont's not the worst thing in the world to do.
No, it's quite gorgeous.
When did you receive your commission?
May 19th, 1989.
Okay. And now you're a second lieutenant. You're a Norwich graduate. You're in the Army. Oh, by the way, how did your father feel about you being in the Army instead of the Air Force?
He didn't talk to me for about 2 months.
Oh.
He was very upset. And he, you know, he still gives me a hard time about it. 29 or 30 years later.
Okay, Lieutenant, tell us what happened next.
So I had a break between when I graduated college and when I went on active duty because they were backlogged in the Signal Corps for second lieutenants going to OBC. So I worked as a chemist and an industrial hygienist for a asbestos abatement lab in Boston for the summer. Actually, it ended up being 3-4 months. And then I was waiting tables too. Gave up my apartment, moved in with my boyfriend's parents in Falmouth, and waited tables at the Captain Kidd in Woods Hole. And that was a lot of fun. It was kind of, you know, carefree, a carefree time in my life, just before I started on active duty. I joined active duty on the 11th of November, 1989. Went to OBC in Fort Gordon, Georgia.
And OBC stands for?
Officer Basic Course.
Okay.
So I went to Officer Basic Course at Fort Gordon, followed on Battalion Brigade Signal Officer Course at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. And from there, I went to Korea. So my first duty assignment was with the 523 MI Battalion, which is part of the 501st MI Brigade. And I was at Zeckler Station and Camp Humphreys in Pyeongtaek, Korea.
Okay, you're in Korea with MI's Military Intelligence?
It is. But I was a signal officer.
Okay, so tell me a little more about being a signal officer.
Well, at first when I found out my branch, I didn't know what it was because I had asked for combat arms, aviation. Aviation was my branch originally, but they changed a requirement for arm reach or arm length, and I got disqualified. And so they switched me to the signal corps because they were short officers. At the time, I tried to get out of my contract because I didn't want to go in the Signal Corps. And looking back, it was hard for me because I wanted to be combat arms, and not being able to get your branch is tough. So I still paid attention, and in hindsight, the Signal Corps has been great for me. Mm-hmm. But at the time, I was mad at the Army because I wanted to be a pilot. And I petitioned 6 times to go to flight school, and they denied my claim for 3 centimeters of arm reach.
3 centimeters? Oh, my goodness. But let's kind of step back a little bit, because here you are, woman officer, you're in the Army. It's sort of like the last bit of peacetime before Pershing go. But what was the overall attitude toward women officers at that time?
I think that depending on where you went, it was, you know, women in the military in general were still not overly accepted. I think that they had the attitude that you were there to find a husband mm-hmm. or you were gay, and this was the only way you could find employment. So it was interesting to be a heterosexual, not interested in getting married right away, and it was hard to get people to look at you objectively. And but I think, you know, performance is performance, and it's not you can't argue performance. And but you definitely had to prove yourself more than your peers that were men. You had to do better. You had to run faster. You had to work harder just to get the same acknowledgement as your peers. So, you know, it kind of sucked, okay. To be honest.
All right. So let's get you back to Korea with the 523rd signal officer. And
as a platoon leader.
As a platoon leader.
Mm-hmm. I had 65 men and women that worked for me. being MI and Signal Corps, both are branches that women are allowed in, always have been, since women were in the Army. So there was, you know, there were plenty of us in those roles. The mission of the platoon was to provide tactical comms for the theater, the senior theater military intelligence officer.
Mm-hmm. And where in Korea were you based?
Pyeongtaek, Camp Humphreys.
How far were you from the border with North Korea?
Actually, fairly far, probably about a two-hour drive, maybe three. Mm-hmm. With Korean traffic, it might be five.
Well, yeah, okay.
But no, it was below Seoul. Mm-hmm. But we had missions along. I did have soldiers at listening post on the DMZ that I used to have to switch out. I had soldiers at CP Tango, which was the mountain that's hollowed out in the go to war headquarters for the command elements within Korea. So that was kind of what we did. Processing top secret information that was transferred via my platoon from all the way from the DMZ to Seoul down to Zakler Station and CP Tango.
And how long were you stationed in Korea?
15 months.
And how would you describe your experience in Korea?
It was a time where I realized that I didn't have a lot else going on because I was remotely located from my company. So I had a lot of freedom, I should say, and not a lot of supervision. And I started getting, I went and started taking master level classes at Osan Air Force Base and really learning what it was like to be an officer, you know, completely failing. Luckily, I had a really good platoon sergeant who would pick me up by my collar and straighten me out and say, well, not that way, ma'am, this way. And he taught me a lot. Mm-hmm. He was really quite good at saying, yeah, not so much, ma'am, that's not going to work. How about we try it this way? You know, when I would have the good idea fairy, and he would say, no, that's not right.
Would you like to mention the name of this platoon sergeant?
Sergeant First Class Coulson. Mm-hmm. I don't remember his first name.
Hopefully he'll be listening.
Very possible.
He'll be seeing this. Okay, so you're spent 15 months in Korea, and how did you like the culture, the people?
I really enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. I think that was one of the things that, you know, you had people that were barracks rats, they stayed in the barracks, they never left post. And then you had the people that only left post go out to the bars. But for me, it was, I tried to see as much of the country as I could when mm-hmm. I was there. I spent a lot of time on tours, MWR tours. And at some point, one of my friends became my boyfriend. And we got engaged on the island of Jeju-do, which is off the southern mm-hmm. coast of Korea. He was a fellow soldier.
I take it the other boyfriend you mentioned earlier was not in the picture anymore?
No, he was just a good friend.
Okay.
You know, he's still a good friend.
Okay. So you got engaged.
I got engaged.
Then
yes.
What happened?
And so we were both getting out of country about the same time because they had kind of stopped lost because of the war in Iraq. So we got out of country about the same time and changed our duty assignments to be the same and ended up in Fort Bliss in El Paso, Texas.
And about what year was this now?
So it would have been 91.
Gulf War.
Right, and I was assigned to the 143 Air Defense Artillery Patriot Battalion.
Mm-hmm. 193?
143.
143, okay, thank you. Patriot Missile?
Correct.
And are you still a second lieutenant?
No, I had gotten promoted to first lieutenant by this time. While I was in Korea.
And what were your duties with the 143?
I was platoon leader again, and the ComSec custodian, communication securities custodian. And I had roughly 70 soldiers. And a very weak platoon sergeant originally. Mm-hmm. And luckily he PCS'd quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So I then got a fairly good one after that. And we spent a lot of time in the desert mm-hmm. training. Lots of time.
Little change from Korea.
Yes.
You know, kind of on a war footing, were you expected to head over?
Yeah, we did rotations.
Mm-hmm.
But it was post-war, so you don't really get credit for it. So we would do rotations. All the Patriot units were doing rotations in Saudi Arabia, but it wasn't considered a war, you know, per se.
Okay.
It was post-war.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Were you stationed in Saudi Arabia?
Just for deployment.
I'm sorry?
Just for undeployment. I wasn't really mm-hmm. stationed there.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got married in August 15th of 1992 to the guy I got engaged to.
All right. And was this down in Texas?
No, we got married in Dunkirk, New York, which is right next door to Fredonia, New York, where I went to high school. And we had, he was from Nebraska, or is from Nebraska.
Okay. How long were you stationed in Fort Bliss?
I finished my initial tour, mm-hmm. and got off active duty on November 12th, 1992. At that time, I went to work for a Procter & Gamble chemical company called J.T. Baker, mm-hmm. and as a techno sales rep. In Charlotte, North Carolina, and joined the reserves immediately.
Tell us what happened next.
I got pregnant.
You got pregnant, okay.
With my amazing daughter, Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
And my ex-husband, he didn't get out as soon as I did. Like he had more obligation than I did. So he got out probably 5 months after I did. And then he went in law enforcement, and I stayed working in the chemical company. But my reserve unit was a Lanes training unit, mm-hmm. out of Fort Gordon, Georgia. I would drive down there for battle or drill. And I was an observer controller for the training.
Are you still a lieutenant?
I was a lieutenant. When I got off active duty, the unit, the 143, was going back to Saudi Arabia, mm-hmm. and they took my records with them. So my records never got to Human Resource Command. And so when I went to go before the 03 board, they didn't have my records and I wasn't promoted. I did do a board of corrections and filed all my paperwork that I had saved copies of and reconstructed my records. And they promoted me, and then they backdated my rank. But it took me about 18 months to fight it.
Okay, you're now a captain in the reserves.
Yes.
Go ahead.
So I had my daughter, mm-hmm. and I got pregnant fairly shortly thereafter with my son, Joshua. And my company got bought by a competitor, mm-hmm. and they asked me to move to Boston. And at that time, my ex-husband wasn't real thrilled with his job in law enforcement in Charlotte. It's pretty dangerous. I wanted to go back to school, so we decided to move here. We settled in Marion, bought the house that I live in now, And he went back to school, and I continued working for the company. At that point, I transferred reserve units to the first of the 98th Training Brigade out of Providence, Rhode Island. It was a drill sergeant basic training unit. And I was initially in their S1, which is, I think I was the worst performance of any soldier ever. I was horrible at it. Absolutely horrible. Completely unsuited for it. But it was a position, so I took it. But I was only there in that role for about 8 months before they asked me to be the headquarters company commander. And so for almost 3 years, I was the headquarters company commander for the 1st of the 98th Training Division, and did a couple missions at Fort Leonard Wood, commanding basic training companies. And this is, you know, the world was very quiet then.
Yeah. So you were commanding officer.
Correct.
For basic training.
For a headquarters company of a brigade mm-hmm. that did basic training.
What's that like doing basic training from the other side?
It was funny though. The first time I was there for it, you kind of had to chuckle because you'd watch these soldiers doing stupid stuff and you know that you did it when you were there. You know you had to. You know you looked as silly as they did and, you know, made as silly mistakes like they were making. And so it was kind of, it wasn't payback because I'm not vindictive. But it was interesting. It definitely was the flip side of the coin, for sure.
Mm-hmm. And now we're going into the mid to late 90s. Did you see attitudes toward women in the military change, or were they pretty much the same?
Depends on who you were working with. Okay. I think the older soldiers still were in that mindset. But the younger soldiers were more representative of society. I mean, I think, you know, the Army is a cross-section of society, and the attitudes of these soldiers represent that society. And I just think, like, the older soldiers that I served with, my boss, you know, the colonel mm-hmm. and the command sergeant majors and the senior NCOs, they were still a little bit, well, back in my day in the Army, we didn't have women, and had this one warrant officer who he was our food service officer, and he was extremely overweight, and I kept putting him on a scale, and he kept calling me cupcake, and I said, you can call me whatever you want, you're still getting on that scale because you're fat and you're not meeting the Army standard. Mm-hmm. And so it was an interesting dynamic, because as a headquarters company commander, most of the people that I commanded outranked me. So well, the warrant officer didn't, but you know, he was a warrant officer 5. You don't see them very often.
Okay. Let's jump a little bit ahead. September 11, 2001. What were you doing?
So I had, between my company command, I was a S3 of a signal battalion, a training signal battalion. And then when I completed that tenure, I went to U.S. Space Command. And I was managing DOD apportionation of commercial satellite capacity that we would lease on an annual basis, and I was managing who got capacity and who didn't. So I was an individual mobilization augmentee, a drilling one, and they pooled myself and 3 or 4 other signal soldiers that were in the same category as I was on active duty, and the minute we got there, they said, you're involuntarily extended indefinitely.
You're in the Army now.
Yeah, so by this time I was divorced. My kids were with my father, so he was retired, so I had to convince him that he needed to stay with them and if it was gonna go too long, I would have pulled them to Colorado, but it was only ended up being 4 months. Mm-hmm. But I spent the invasion on Baghdad, September 11th, this is post-September 11th, mm-hmm. so, but I was not on duty the day of the bombings of the September 11th, I was in my civilian capacity.
Okay.
But it was shortly thereafter that everything got spun up and
they went, yoo-hoo.
Yeah, exactly. But I spent the invasion of Baghdad and Cheyenne Mountain watching the war on Blue Force Tracker, which is the every vehicle has a system in it so we can keep track of and communicate with each other and stuff like that. But basically watching it, making sure that there wasn't any jamming of the Blue Force Tracker system. We did a lot of green-on-green jamming, unintentional jamming. There was some other jamming issues associated with what was going on. Saddam's force did have satellite jammers, so we were working issues with that, comsec changeover, things like that. But pretty much 12 hours on a day. I think every like 4 days I would get a day off, 4 or 5 days I would get a day off. Mm-hmm. So that was for 4 months during the initial assault on Baghdad. And my ex-husband, he was in the Massachusetts National Guard at the time, military policeman, and he went to Iraq, I think, I want to say May to December of that year. So he was gone. At that time.
So you're in Cheyenne Mountain, Wyoming?
It's in Colorado.
Colorado, okay, thank you. Keeping Saddam from jamming everything in sight.
What was your rank at the I was a major.
You're now a major?
Mm-hmm. I got promoted to, during my tenure as the Battalion S3. Mm-hmm. I started out as a senior captain and then got promoted shortly thereafter.
And we're now talking 2002,
2003? 2003.
Tell us what happened next.
So I stayed with Space Command for another 2 years. They became part of U.S. STRATCOM at that point, and the whole headquarters moved to Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska. And so I was flying out still to do my duty. The job changed a lot, though, at that point, and I was making the decision whether I didn't really want to stay completely signal because I didn't think there was a lot of career options. So I was deciding whether I was going to go space specialty or information operations specialty. And I chose information operations. So this is now 2004. And I went to the Northeast Information Operations Command, which is at Devens, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. And I was there for 3 months and was told I was being mobilized to go to Iraq. So that was the fall of 2004. I started doing some training in early 2005. They said, oh no, we don't need you. I said, okay. And then the next team that went out the door, they said, hey, we do need you. We're sending you with this team that you don't know from a different unit. And so I had gone to my functional area 30 information operations school. I had also gone to Military Deception School, Operation Security Planner School, and a bunch of electronic warfare and cyber. So I've been to all the proper schools. And so in September 2005, I was mobilized for 20 months. And I did train up at First Information Operations Command at Fort Belvoir from September through the end of December.
And where is Fort Belvoir?
It's outside of, it's in Alexandria, Virginia.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Right outside D.C. And then the 2nd of January, I flew to Fort Bliss to what they call CRC. What does that stand for? Command Replacement Center, mm-hmm. I think, where they send individuals to replace other people. And so myself and my team went to Fort Bliss and then on to Iraq through Kuwait.
All righty, you're off to Iraq.
So I spent 2006 in Iraq.
And where in Iraq?
I was in Afal Palace in Baghdad.
So at Camp Victory.
And I was the lead information operations planner for Multinational Corps Iraq.
And what were your duties?
So I was a planner. Mm-hmm. So any exercise, because information operations kind of goes across operations, any exercise that was from current operations through 6 months out that was going through planning, I would be participating in. Or one of my soldiers that work for me.
Are you a colonel yet or still a major?
I was a major.
Still a major, okay.
The team lead was actually a lieutenant colonel, mm-hmm. Who, God, he was a mess. He was so incompetent. He fell out about, I guess in February, he had hurt his back or something, and they sent him back to Longstuhl for treatment. And I don't know what he did there, but he ended up staying in Germany for like a month. And they said, you're fine. They sent him back. But at that point, he was marginalized. So he just kind of sat in the corner and colored, as they say. And I led the team starting then. He went on R&R in June, went on his 2 weeks home, and he never returned. He was actually AWOL. Mm-hmm. And you're like, Major McLaughlin, where's your colonel? And I have no idea. I don't know. So anyway, so I officially took over the team at that point. And then they sent us a captain from First Information Operations Command to take his place. But I was working a lot with the Marines, mm-hmm. in Anbar province. And also up in Mosul and around the Haditha Dam on some operations. Influencing operations. Mm-hmm. I was also working with my one-star general on his engagements, where he would go out and meet different leaders within the Iraqi government. I worked with the Minister of the Interior on trying to learn how to talk to his population and do public information. He never quite got that, actually. And then we were working on, there was a couple ops that I can talk about. There's many, mm-hmm. I can't, but there was one that I would call Kids Against Violence, like kind of like SAD, Students Against Drunk Driving, where we were helping the Iraqi police get more acceptance and support within their population. And they were working with the schools and the school students to denounce violence, so to report it. If you see somebody digging an IED hole, to report it. If you see someone with arms that they're not supposed to have, to report it, and stuff like that. And we touched 250,000 students within Iraq with this program, and it was fairly successful. Mm-hmm. Our metrics were very good as far as it showing some kind of effectiveness of the program. So that was one, and we worked on another one where so Saddam used to prohibit the date palm farmers from spraying for this little weevil beetle, mm-hmm. that used to eat all the dates. And it's a huge part of their economy in Iraq. So they think they're next to California, the second largest date producer in the world. Mm-hmm. But this particular beetle had infested all the groves, and they couldn't harvest. So we did the date palm spraying for the first time to help promote the economic ability for the farmers to make money. Mm-hmm. And so that was one of the programs that we worked on too. Mm-hmm. And it was really just informing the population that we're doing it to stay indoors during the time so they don't get exposed, that it's not us gassing them, that we actually, this is good, this is a positive thing. So a lot of public information type of stuff.
So judging from what you've just described, you were kind of out and about among the Iraqi population. What was that like?
I think it being a woman, it's particularly interesting. Mm-hmm. Meeting with the senior leadership was harder. They would sometimes talk to my interpreter like he had some kind of decision authority. And I'd have to keep saying, hey, no, here, right, mm-hmm. here, not him. He's just, when I open my mouth, his mouth should be opening. That's it. Mm-hmm. I make all the decisions here. So that was hard because it was just they're not used to women in a position of authority, even when you're in uniform. So that was you know, convincing them that they had to deal with me because that was all there, or they weren't going to get the support that they were looking for. So that was interesting. Walking around the streets, I had a lot of women touch me, which was interesting because you weren't sure if they're friend or foe. But they would definitely come up and touch you and, you know, pat you and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I don't speak Arabic, so I have no idea what they were actually saying to me. They could have been calling me a terrible thing. I would never know.
You were just mentioning a uniform. Were you wearing, like, the full...
Oh, yeah, you had to. Mm-hmm. You had to. So 2006 was a pretty violent year in Iraq. It was when the Golden Mosque bombing happened. A lot of progress that they had made went kind of backwards when that happened. And the IEDs and the EFPs, they called them, which were a little bit more stronger IEDs, were, you know, very prevalently used during that time. So when you went out, you were in, I think I weighed, I had lost a lot of weight while I was there, because, you know, it's so hot, you don't want to eat. And plus I'm walking everywhere, like my can where I lived to my work was in mile. So I'd walk a mile, and then from our where we worked to the dining facility was half a mile. So given any day, at minimum 6 mile walk. And then I was working out and doing physical training, PT mm-hmm. on top of it. But I was really thin, so I finally had bought myself a scale because I was a little worried about my weight. At one point during the, I had on drugstore.com had it sent, and I was a little worried because I had lost a lot. I was starting to really notice that I had lost so much weight, and so I got on the scale and I weighed like 116 or something like that, and then I got off and I put all my gear on and I got back on the scale and it ended up weighing about 65 pounds. So it was double me, or half me, I should say, mm-hmm. That I would wear. But you know, your helmet, your vest, the plates, the shoulder the daps. You had something that would come down here to protect your femoral artery, and then you had your weapon and your basic load of ammunition and your first aid kit, and it just, you know, like you're walking like the Michelin Man a little bit. But mm-hmm. But whenever you went out. In a convoy or on a, you know, going out to on a patrol or whatever, you had to wear that. And we were expected to keep it on during the meetings too, just in case there's a bomber or kidnappings happen quite a bit too. Mm-hmm. Especially, that was the biggest concern when I was meeting with the Minister of the Interior. One time when we were there, there was a kidnapping of one of their officials in the same building. So that was interesting, yeah.
Woo!
But I got to see a lot of Iraq. Mm-hmm. My one-star general, General Horn, liked to go out and visit, and he liked to have me with him. I never could figure out why. I think I was the only one that didn't tell him no. I'm not sure.
Well, you were a bit lower rank at the time.
Yeah, like, I really couldn't have said no. But okay. Like, between him and myself, there was a couple lieutenant colonels and a couple colonels. So,
and as far as the camp life was concerned, were you able to communicate with your family?
So it was you really weren't supposed to have cell phones because mm-hmm. we knew that there were compromised. The cell phone network in Iraq was compromised, the civilian one, and uh-huh. so they really didn't want you to have one. But I did have one, and I. Would keep it on only in case of an emergency. My kids only knew to call me if there was an emergency, which there was a couple, one in particular. But the most part, it would be via email, or I would call them at a predetermined time. A couple of the operations that I was working on were military deception programs, and I had to get approval from the CENTCOM commander to do them. So I did end up coming back to the U.S. to brief him. So when I was in the U.S., I didn't get to see my kids, except for when I went on R&R in September of that year. I would at least be able to talk to them. That was really before FaceTime came
right.
out.
Uh-huh.
Skype, I think, was just coming out at the
uh-huh.
time. So.
And as far as you mentioning the weight loss, but was Camp life okay? Was it, did you
It was
have
boring. I mean, there really wasn't, I was working 17, 18 hour days. When I wasn't even, when I was traveling, sometimes there'd be a sandstorm and you'd get stuck in the middle of nowhere. Luckily, you know, hopefully you brought, you know, some food with you, an MRE or something. But there really wasn't, you know, minus working out and maybe watching a movie here or there, there really wasn't much to do. Like, I know my roommate had a social life. It was kind of, I'm like, I don't know how you do it. She, her work schedule was a lot different than mine, mm-hmm. but she was, she's still in the service. She's a great woman, Colonel D. Godfrey. But she would go out country line dancing and go to all the concerts MWR put on, and I don't know how she had the time to do it, but she did, you know. So she had a social life while we were there, but I didn't, because I, you know, I was working too much, and then when I wasn't working, I was trying to finish my one of my schooling to become a lieutenant colonel while I was there, intermediate learning, ILE, and. So there was writing papers after I got off duty, sitting at my desk. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so it was really boring. There wasn't much to do. But I mean, you know, like it was fun because you know the thing about deployment is everybody's deployment's different, and it's the people that you're there with that make it. And I had a great team. Once our lieutenant colonel went away, went AWOL.
Oh dear.
Yeah, it was embarrassing. It was an embarrassment. But yeah, there. So it wasn't. I read a lot.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And you were. How long were you stationed in Iraq?
12 months.
12 months. So we're going into January.
The whole year, 2006.
Okay, so January 2007. You are
back at Fort Belvoir. Mm-hmm. My 20 months hadn't finished, so I was at Belvoir for January, February, and March of 2007. During that time, we were training up the teams that were going out the door next. And I had the opportunity to go to Oberammergau, Germany, and teach at the NATO school. Mm. So I taught information operations, a course at the NATO school in Bavaria, Germany. That was very fun. That was a really good time. It was not just the fact that I could actually have a beer for the first time in you know how long. It was just the experience of being with the coalition forces, mm-hmm. and in my small group breakout, I had people from Croatia, Spain, Italy, the Netherlands, Denmark, Germany. It was just really quite unique experience. So.
And then what happened after that?
So I went back to, came back home, mm-hmm. and at that point I was selected to command the 1st Information Operations Reserve Element and got promoted to Lieutenant Colonel early as a result of it. So I was probably a year ahead of when I should have been promoted to Lieutenant Colonel. And so I would go down to Fort Belvoir for my battle for my drills, and then went back to work. I was working for a contract manufacturing organization in biotech. Like my civilian career, I switched over to biotech after mm-hmm. I worked for J.T. Baker, and so I was working for, and it was a British biotech company, and they didn't save my job, so they hired 2 people to replace me. And so when I came back, I don't think they expected me to come back. And I'm like, all right, I'm here, guys. Where's my job? And they're like, oh, we don't have a job for you. So I worked for them from April through probably August. And they gave me a severance to keep me quiet and not sue them. So they gave me a pretty decent severance. But it was, you know, it takes a while to find a new job. And so I went to work for a consulting company for a while and did consulting. And then in April of 2008, I started working for a biotech company from Oklahoma City, mm-hmm. Doing business development sales, basically. At that time, I was still at First IO Command, and then at about the same time, actually, I got selected to be a battalion commander of the 301st IO Battalion. at Fort Totten, New York. And so I'm missing an assignment in there. Okay, so between 1st IO Command and when I got selected for Battalion Command, I went to work for the Defense Threat Reduction Agency at Fort Belvoir, and was their lead IO planner and wrote the IO portion of their plans to protect the homeland and to counter proliferation of weapons of mass destruction globally. So I wrote the IO plan for that part, for their overall plans. And I was only with them for about 8 months. I did some work with their commander who was testifying in front of Congress, and so I helped write some of his congressional testimony. And then, like I said, that it was only 8 months, and then I got selected for battalion command, which I loved being a battalion commander. And it was a new unit. I was the first commander. So I had to build the organization, but we were sending soldiers to Afghanistan within 6 months of me taking command. So we were pretty successful in getting everybody ramped up. And for myself, for my own missions, I was doing a lot of exercise work with EUCOM at the time, European Command. So they have a couple of annual exercises, and I was there helping them out with being their lead planner for those exercises for my own duty. And then I went to Kuwait in 2010. That was the last year I was in command, and did an exercise there and helped write a couple plans that are associated with the surrounding countries from Kuwait. some that are I've seen implemented today. So. Okay. From battalion command, I was still working for the company in Oklahoma. I helped them raise a round of financing, and they changed a bunch of stuff around, and so I left the company because it was just time. I went to work for a Canadian company developing technology for manufacturing therapeutic monoclonal antibodies for drugs. My degree, I never told you this, but my bachelor's degree was in biology.
Okay.
And then I have a master's in adult education, a master's in organizational leadership, and a master's from the War College in strategic studies. I was trying to get my PhD, but I couldn't. It ran out of time, and so they kicked me out of the program. It was too many deployments, too many... having to go to War College and do that at the same time was too much, so I couldn't finish it. So after battalion command, I went to go work for the Joint Enabling Capabilities Command, which is a joint unit at Norfolk, Virginia, at the Norfolk Naval Base. And their mission, they have three different subdivisions, and I was in the Joint Planning Support Element. And the mission was, in the event that there was something that went on globally, and they had to set up a joint task force, this unit would send this joint task force staff to the forwardly deployed area and get things going and starting and running up to 90 days. And at that point, then the combatant commander would have to backfill the team with his own people or her own people. And at that point, then we would redeploy. So I was with them for 10 months. I was on two of the teams that were ready to go. I was about to go to fill one of these roles, and I got picked up for 06 to colonel and also brigade command. So I actually commanded the brigade that my battalion was in when I was a battalion commander. So after 3 years, battalion command was 3 years, they changed it, so it was supposed to be a two-year tenure. So I took over brigade command in February of 2013. And commanded a brigade from February 2013 till just this past August.
Wow.
So they extended me in command 6 months. We sent at least 10 teams a year to support other joint task force and other commands doing information operation planning and operations, to include cyber. So that was the mission of my brigade, and had very successful command.
Mm. Not to mention busy.
Yeah, I was very busy.
So what are you doing these days?
So I took a position with the 311th Theater Signal Command out of PACOM, out of Pacific Command. I'm their senior reservist. The commander, Major General Brock, is a USAR soldier, but as a general officer, they pull you back and forth as much as they need it, as they need. I joined them the end of August. Spent some time in Hawaii in September, kind of getting to know the mission of the unit, and then we'll be going to, I was like in California this past weekend. The actual headquarters of the unit is in California, in Orange County. So getting back to my signal roots, because I was kind of at the top of the food chain for information operations. I don't know how much you know about information operations, probably nothing. Okay. So information operations has been around for probably about 15, 20 years, maybe 15. Mm-hmm. I've been in it for 10, so yeah, about 15. And it really was, the whole concept of it is controlling information on the battlefield, keeping it from the enemy, getting our commander's information that's timely and accurate, and the whole purpose is so that our commanders can make good decisions while influencing our enemies to make bad decisions or decisions we want them to make. So it's a lot of influencing operations. It's also changing public perception, changing public attitude, getting them to support certain activities that we might be doing and denouncing the activities of the people we don't want them to be supporting. As part of that is using psychological warfare. So I have some expertise in psychological warfare. Military deception is actually my specialty within IO. So using deception on the battlefield to give an advantage to our commanders. I did a lot of that while I was away. I actually still am involved in some stuff with that. Operation security, so restricting the amount of information that we give that's not classified but just sensitive information to the enemy. And part of that is looking at how vulnerable are we to being collected on and figuring out a way how we can resolve those vulnerabilities and keep the enemy from gaining information about ourselves, whether it's keeping soldiers from talking about stuff they're not supposed to uniform. I mean, there's all kinds of ways that intelligence guys can collect. I mean, we do the same thing. So it's just trying to restrict that their access to that information. And then public information, because public affairs, everyone says that's public affairs. Well, it's not. Public affairs only targets U.S. audiences. We can't target U.S. audiences. We target everybody else. And so local populations, getting them to be informed, you know, like, we're going to blow up this ammo supply depot. You need to leave the area. That's something we would do versus public affairs, because it's not a U.S. audience. And then the cyber elements of it, computer network operations, computer defense, using cyber as a way to deliver psychological warfare messages to a particular audience. So if you have a Islamic extreme website or something like that, for example, collecting on that and then maybe manipulating the information a little bit, or taking the website down.
Right.
So those are the kind of, I mean, this is all kind of open source information. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying anything that's classified. The whole combination and synchronizing all those efforts, and so that in making sure that they're in the plans for, so that you, instead of going straight to a kinetic solution of blowing something up, we can influence the situation so that we can get the same effect without going to a lethal, save lives type of thing.
So you're heading out to California at some point?
Yeah, so I'll be going out there for my battle assemblies. Pretty much on a monthly basis, And then I've been, right now I'm looking at whether or not they really need me, and I'm not sure.
Okay.
So I'm looking at other options as well.
All right, well.
Some of them are not in the U.S.
Well, okay, why not? So have your children expressed interest in joining the military?
They were very much for it, having both parents in the military. But I think when my ex went to Iraq and then I was gone for so long, mine was excessive. 20 months is excessive. My son, in particular, my youngest, he was all about going to West Point or Norwich or someplace like that. And when I came back, he's like, there's no way. There's no way I would put anybody through what you put me through, Mom.
Oh, dear.
So he's very anti-military. And my daughter's just very extremely liberal. She wants to work for the State Department, maybe USAID. She's in Switzerland right now getting her. She graduated from University of Vermont last
cool.
year. And she's in Switzerland now getting her master's degree in public policy and international politics.
Interesting kids.
Yeah. And my son's at UMass Boston.
Yeah. Bacon. He's a beacon.
I got one of my master's there.
Uh-huh. Well, you certainly have been keeping very, very active in the military. Do you see yourself in the military for a few more years at least?
Yes. So kind of funny thing happened. I was told I was eligible to give my children my GI Bill benefits, and so I did. Mm-hmm. And I incurred an obligation to the military as a result of it, and then they declined their claim. So I'm in the middle of fighting that whole system right now.
Oh, dear.
Because I used my GI Bill to pay for my education, but it was a Montgomery Reserve. It was a different type. And so I think that there's... they need to make either a change to their policy on it, or anyway, I'm going to fight it. I'm going to take it as far as I can go, because
okay.
I think it's inappropriate. To be a colonel, I have to have a master's degree, and the GI Bill benefits don't even provide you enough benefits to get a master's degree. So there's a disconnect in what the military wants you to have as an officer, and what their benefits are giving you. So there's definitely a disconnect.
Right.
So I think it's not just for myself and my own kids, but for the other soldiers and servicemen and women.
You were just mentioning the GI Bill. Being a Massachusetts resident, have you been taking advantage of some of the programs and other benefits being offered?
Well, I mean, my master's degree that I did get from UMass Boston, I only had to pay student fees. So that was good.
And... what do you know about the Mass Women Veterans Network?
So I just discovered them recently. And I participated in a retreat in last month in October down in Lakeville, and it was lovely. It was great to meet these really interesting, really dynamic, very successful women. Some of these women are, you know, they were in the Army, you know, the WAC. They were in the Army when the Army was just starting out, and there were a lot of nurses. The older veterans were a lot of more nurses or medical, but some of them were hardcore, you know, Women's Army Corps. So they were really impressive and very neat, and I love to hear their stories and what they, you know, they experienced back when in the late 60s, 70s. You know, it's just crazy stuff. But yeah, so I think I will try to play a more active role in that organization now that I've discovered them. Like I said, it's just recent that I have, so I'm just starting out. But I'll be in the Army until, with my obligation that I have, my mandatory retirement date is June of 2019, unless I get promoted to 07, to Brigadier General. I went before the Brigadier General Board, Selection Board, in October. I have no idea the results. I can't get anyone to tell me what they're looking for. So I have no idea if I'm close. It's in a lot of it, they say, oh, it's who you know. And unfortunately, with information operations, I'm very well known within information operations. But outside of that specialty, I'm not very well known. Like, people don't know who I am because it's, you know, we work with a lot of the Special Forces groups. So I'm not in mainstream Army very much. And so that's probably going to hinder my selection to general.
Well, I hope not.
I'm not sure. We'll see. Like I said, I have no idea what their selection criteria is, or what they're looking for. Do they need someone who has non-lethal, non-kinetic cyber background or not? I don't know.
Molly, have you joined any other organizations such as the Legion or VFW, or you just?
So I have to remember which one it is. So I was at Alumni Weekend at Norwich because I'm on the Board of Fellows. So I was there for a Board of Fellows meeting, and I stayed for the football game on Saturday. And some classmates of mine had started, I think it's the VFW, a post-18-19, that's the year that Norwich was founded, and they talked me into joining. So so just that October, I just got confirmed as a member,
okay,
officially. But I mean, I haven't done anything with them at all, so.
What has serving in the military meant for you?
You know, I think it's, like I said, I knew early on that I felt an obligation to serve, and every time I go away for one of my deployments anywhere in the world, or even when I, because I travel extensively internationally for my civilian job in biotech, I reaffirm that America's the best place in the world, and our freedom is worth making sacrifices of my own personal freedom, because it's not free. We have to fight for it, and I think that we're getting to a stage in our global history where it's going to become even more relevant that we stay in the fight and that we keep our borders safe and our civilian population safe, because it's not, you know, ISIS isn't going away, and if ISIS goes away, there'll be somebody else, XYZ. Terrorist organization. Asymmetrical warfare is here to stay. It's effective. They know they can take us out with very specific targeting of specific, they would call them high payoff targets. And you know, they're not going away. And I'm here until they say you're too old to continue that fight, because it is real. It's a real threat. And I think for what I do as a non-lethal influencing op expert in the Army, my role and people like me is going to increase to combat the asymmetrical nature of our threat. So, I mean, for me, it has meant, I just see the need for it. And if not, like I had someone back when you could travel in uniform, I was getting a rental car in uniform, and this woman came up to me and said, "You're so pretty. Why are you in the military? Why would you do that to yourself?" And I said, "Well, if not me, who? Who would? Are you going to do it?" "Well, no, God, I would never join the military." "Well, then who's going to do it? Who's going to protect you?" I don't think that was the reaction she expected. But I was offended by her completely. And it's just, you know, it's real. We have to keep them on the run. We have to protect our civilians. We have to protect our future. And there's, you know, whether it's an economic threat, a global economy threat, or whether it's a physical attacks on in our land, on our, you know, in our country, in our borders, it's there, and it's going to happen again. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's not just a, you know, I know everybody's focused on the Muslim extremists now because of what's just happened in Paris and everything, but it's not just the Muslim extremists. Mm-hmm. There's other threats. And Americans have a very short memory, and they forget September 11th. There's a generation of school kids that have no idea what it is. You know, they're not being reminded of it. But it's going to happen again. Mm-hmm. And I will serve until I can't to help prevent it, stop it, whatever I can do.
Okay. Well, Colonel Molly McLaughlin, we thank you so much for coming in and interviewing for the Veterans Oral History Project.
You're quite welcome. Thank you for having me.
Mm-hmm.